Ladies and gentlemen, please continue to eat your lunches while I introduce our final keynote speaker, Ms. Rose Gottmuller. Ms. Gottmuller is the Acting Undersecretary of State for Arms Control and International Security, the U.S. Department of State. Ms. Gottmuller was the chief U.S. negotiator for the new Strategic Arms Reduction Treaty with the Russian Federation. Prior to the Department of State in 2000, she became a senior associate with the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, where she also served as the director of the Carnegie Moscow Center. In 1998 through 2000, she was the Deputy Undersecretary of Energy for Defense Nuclear Nonproliferation. She was the Assistant Secretary for Energy for Nonproliferation and National Security, where she was responsible for all nonproliferation cooperation with Russia and the newly independent states. Prior to her work at the Department of Energy, Ms. Gottmuller served for 3 years as the Deputy Director of the International Institute for Strategic Studies in London. Ms. Gottmuller received her Bachelor of Science and her Master of Arts from Georgetown University. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Ms. Rose Gottmuller.
General Kaler, I was having too much fun over lunch. I didn't know I had to speak quite so soon, but this is good, really good. No, actually, I'm very, very grateful to be here today and to have an opportunity to speak to this distinguished audience. This conference has become the conference to talk about deterrence policy, and from that perspective, it is a very impressive gathering, and it is very good to be here. I only arrived this morning, but the panel I was able to sit in on this morning was very high quality, and I'm sure all of your discussions have had that same level of intellectual rigor and also interest attached to them. I'm glad to see so many rainmakers around the room. This is a real group of Washington rainmakers, but from also other parts of our country, and also glad to see that you had the effect of actually bringing some rain to Nebraska, much needed. And the other thing I want to say, General Kaler, is this is a unique conference from another perspective. This is the very first time I have ever seen two Roses as plenary speakers. So, good on you, General Kaler. Thank you. Thank you very much. I don't know if Rose McDermott is still here, but I heard about her remarks. Oh, very good. Well, I heard about your remarks last night, and I'm sorry that I had to miss them. It sounded like a really great presentation. But now let me move into the serious part of my presentation today. I wanted to talk to you about our extended deterrence relationship with our European allies and partners. To begin with, however, I'd also like to update you on New START, which has been in force now for 18 months, and its implementation is going extremely, extremely well. This year alone, the treaty year begins in February, and this year alone we've already had 9 inspections. Our inspectors were just out in Russia last week, and we have been exchanging over 2,700 notifications with the Russian Federation through that period. I know many of you around the room are engaged in at first hand in that effort, but it is significant, I think, in that it has given us again a very clear snapshot into the internal workings of the Russian Strategic Rocket Forces and all of their nuclear forces. So it's been very valuable, I think, in enhancing once again our knowledge and understanding of what is going on with the Russian nuclear forces. The robust verification regime of the New START Treaty is providing predictability and mutual confidence at a time when we need it. When President Obama laid out his vision for the peace and security of a world without nuclear weapons in Prague in 2009, he made it clear that we will need to maintain our deterrence commitments while also taking into account the threats of the 21st century. The President knows that the road to Prague will be very long indeed. Success will only be reached through a step-by-step process in which we maintain and support a safe, secure, and effective stockpile sufficient to deter any adversary and guarantee the defense of our allies, at the same time that we pursue responsible reductions through arms control. We are now spending a lot of time thinking about our next steps in deterrence, stability, and arms control. I sometimes refer to it as our homework period. I think that's an apt way to describe it. We are looking at fundamentals and lessons learned as we work to develop new policies to advance our security. And once again, that's why I so valued the discussion at this morning's panel. It gets to some of the fundamentals that we need to continue to discuss and debate. And so I truly commend the organizers of this conference, and I hope that its work will continue. For arms control, looking at fundamentals means pulling back to a very basic level. Simply put, arms control contributes to international security by committing nations to submit voluntarily to regimes that limit the development, production, stockpiling, and deployment of weapons. Because arms control is based on reciprocity and is typically accompanied by verification, confidence building, and transparency measures, it helps to build predictability into relationships. Limiting force levels and establishing a regime through a mutually verifiable agreement creates boundaries, promotes standard operating procedures, and fosters predictable behavior. These are the building blocks of trust. The relative improvement of trust between parties can help increase stability, in particular when this improvement is underwritten by a verification mechanism. This process can shift a relationship from one based on coercive formulations of deterrence to one based on mutual restraint. Mutual restraint does not remove the need for deterrence, but it does reflect a shared interest in limiting strategic competition. Mutual restraint, along with the stability provided by arms control agreements, can help to prevent escalation during crises by reducing the imperatives to go first. It can also create the conditions for further nuclear reductions. The State Department's International Security Advisory Board, or ISAB, is helping us with some big thinking right now. This federal advisory committee was established to provide the Department of State with a continuing source of independent insight, advice, and innovation on scientific, military, diplomatic, political, and public diplomacy aspects of arms control. The ISAB was asked by former Undersecretary of State Ellen Tauscher, who is well known to many of you, to undertake a study of how the United States could pursue and manage a transition from a world of mutually assured destruction to a world of mutually assured stability, characterized by increasingly interdependent states having incentives to cooperate on political, military, and economic issues, thereby reducing the need for adversarial approaches to managing strategic deterrence. Among the topics that the ISAB was asked to examine and assess in this area were the possible components of mutual assured stability. What level the United States would need to see happen to have confidence in considering very low numbers of nuclear weapons and eventually agree to elimination of nuclear weapons. The report of the ISAB on this matter is forthcoming, and I commend it to you. When it hits the street, I think it will again add to the debate and discussion at the current time. Now let me turn to the topic of reducing the salience of nuclear weapons. In addition to exploring new ideas and concepts of deterrence and arms control, this president and his administration are committed to reducing the role of nuclear weapons in our national security strategy. We are not developing new nuclear weapons or pursuing new nuclear missions. We have committed not to use or threaten to use nuclear weapons against non-nuclear weapon states that are party to the NPT and in compliance with their nuclear non-proliferation obligations. And we have clearly stated that it is in everyone's interest to extend forever the more than 65-year record of non-use of nuclear weapons. As we continue to reduce nuclear stockpiles on a global basis and include additional categories of weapons in that process, the importance of verification and transparency will only grow. Having confidence in what other states are doing is critical for creating the conditions for further progress in arms control and disarmament, which is why we made our 2010 nuclear posture review public and revealed the size of our stockpile, 5,113 weapons as of September 2009. As part of the implementation of the 2010 Nuclear Posture Review, the United States government is currently reviewing its nuclear deterrence requirements to ensure that they are aligned to address today's threats. What we already know, as President Obama said in Seoul this past March at the Nuclear Security Summit, is that we have more nuclear weapons than we need. This study will help to shape our next negotiations with the Russian Federation. Now let me turn to non-strategic nuclear weapons and our extended deterrence relationships. Both the President and the Senate in the new START resolution of ratification placed a priority on seeking to initiate new negotiations with the Russians on non-strategic nuclear weapons. Over the course of the past few years, the administration has taken a number of steps toward this goal. We've been conducting our own internal review while also reviewing this matter with our allies through the Deterrence and Defense Posture Review, and we've also been talking to the Russian Federation about it. In approving the Deterrence and Defense Posture Review, or DDPR, last May in Chicago, the allies determined that NATO's current posture meets the criteria for an effective deterrence and defense. NATO has already dramatically reduced its holdings of and reliance on nuclear weapons, but has indicated that it is prepared to consider further reducing its requirements for non-strategic nuclear weapons assigned to the alliance in the context of reciprocal steps by Russia, taking into account the greater Russian stockpile of non-strategic nuclear weapons in the Euro-Atlantic area. The Allies have supported and encouraged the United States and Russian Federation to continue their mutual efforts to promote strategic stability, enhance transparency, and further reduce their nuclear weapons in every category. NATO allies look forward to developing and exchanging transparency and confidence-building ideas with Russia, with the goal of developing detailed proposals on and increasing mutual understanding of NATO's and Russia's non-strategic nuclear weapons in Europe. And we will be continuing these efforts even this fall as we work with our NATO allies and Russia on this notion of enhancing and expanding our transparency cooperation. Now let me turn to conventional arms control in Europe, a topic perhaps to set the stage a little bit, not really, but a little bit for our discussion of conventional long-range systems after lunch today, but flipping from the nuclear to the conventional side. You know, conventional arms control, I think, oftentimes has been neglected a bit in recent times, and that's because, honestly, it has been a spectacular success since we first undertook it in the closing years of the Cold War. While we're continuing to work on the non-strategic nuclear force issues, it's important to keep in mind, however, the importance of European security overall. As Secretary Clinton stated in 2010, a strong Europe is critical to our security and our prosperity. Much of what we hope to accomplish globally depends on working together with Europe. In this context, predictable conventional force structures in Europe will contribute to enhancing European security and strengthening trust, including between the NATO allies and Russia. Our conventional arms control agreements in Europe, there are three in that set that are the most important pillars, I would say, of conventional arms control. The Conventional Forces in Europe Treaty, CFE, the Open Skies Treaty, and the Vienna Document, confidence building measures, they are vital to providing a foundation for stability in our strategic relationships. NATO confirmed the importance of conventional arms control at the Chicago Summit last May. Reaffirming the importance of the Conventional Forces in Europe Treaty, allies remain committed to conventional arms control and to preserving, strengthening, and modernizing the conventional arms control regime in Europe based on key principles and commitments. Modernization is the key word here. We have made a serious investment in building the current security architecture in Europe. We must devote adequate resources to keeping the regime strong. However, at the same time, we can't keep doing everything as we've been doing it before. We must adapt and improve our efforts to meet our current and future security needs, at the same time doing it in a way that is efficient and effective for all the countries involved, bearing in mind that all of the countries involved are facing defense budget it stringencies. We need some new thinking, and we have been devoting a lot of time to this task. If we look back over the course of CFE implementation, as I said at the outset, this regime has been a spectacular success. Since its entry into force, more than 72,000 pieces of Cold War military equipment, tanks, armored combat vehicles, artillery, combat aircraft, and attack helicopters have been eliminated. Under CFE, thousands of inspections have taken place at military sites all over Europe, dramatically increasing confidence in military transparency on the continent by providing the means to verify the data exchanges. Despite these achievements, the earlier success of the treaty is proving difficult to replicate. In November 2011, the United States, along with 23 other parties to the treaty, ceased carrying out certain obligations under the CFE treaty with regard to the Russian Federation. This step was a legal countermeasure to Russia's step in late 2007 when it ceased suspended its implementation of the treaty. While ceasing to implement an arms control obligation is not something that the administration usually sees as a positive step, in this case, there was, I think, a considerable silver lining. The November 2011 decision has allowed us to embark upon a ground-up reexamination of the entire conventional arms control enterprise. We're asking the fundamental questions. What are the security concerns in Europe in 2012 that a conventional arms control agreement should address? And taking into account the lessons learned from implementation of CFE and other existing agreements, what kinds of arms control measures could address these concerns and uphold core principles of European security? The fact is, the basic problem that the CFE treaty was meant to resolve, the destabilizing surplus of conventional weapons on the continent, has been resolved, and in no small part through implementation of this important treaty. Today, for the most part, quantities of conventional armaments across the continent are way below the negotiated ceilings of the CFE treaty, and they're likely to continue to drop. While the problems of 1989 are no longer, it is my view that conventional arms control, done right, can significantly improve security on the continent by helping to address today's security concerns. It can provide confidence regarding military forces and intentions of neighbors, especially in sensitive areas. We need to spend our stretched defense budgets wisely. Arms control can help us to do that, for the more predictable our relationships, the better that we can plan for our defense spending. With that, I'd like to stop, and I understand, I believe I have time to take a few questions, if that's acceptable. I'm happy to do so if we have means of doing so. My final thought, though, is the following. Our extended deterrence relationship with NATO allies is made up of many facets, as was recognized in the Deterrence and Defense Posture Review. Nuclear, conventional, and missile defense capabilities all contribute to extended deterrence, and they all require constant tending. One more vital facet is the arms control relationship with Europe that has been in place since the Cold War, and this includes Russia. It, too, requires constant tending. If that relationship goes begging, then we will all be the worse for it, including the Russian Federation. Thank you very much for your attention, and now I'd be happy to take a few questions. Thank you. Do we have any questions? Do we have the means of asking questions?
Yes, we do.
Okay. One in back?
Yes. Bill Gertz, I'm a national security journalist. There's been some concern on Capitol Hill that a follow-up arms agreement with Russia may be an executive accord as opposed to something that would be submitted to the Senate. Can you comment on whether that's the case, and what are you looking at in terms of a start follow-on?
Well, the President, Bill, was very clear when we went to Prague to sign the new START treaty that he had in mind pursuing further reductions with the Russian Federation. Those reductions would include non-strategic nuclear weapons as well as further reductions in deployed nuclear weapons and, for the first time, non-deployed nuclear weapons, which, by the way, those two categories, non-strategic and non-deployed, represents some particular challenges in that we've never attempted to do that before. So it is, I think, very important to prepare ourselves carefully for the next round of negotiations. So that's what we are doing today. We have, I think, a good dialogue begun with the Russian Federation. Again, my predecessor in this position, Ellen Tauscher, started a very solid series of strategic stability talks with the Russian Federation that are really beginning to lay the groundwork for the next stage of nuclear reduction negotiations. By the way, I like to remind everybody, too, that there is an important line in the preamble to the New START Treaty that says the New START Treaty is but a step on the pathway. Essentially, it says New START is the part of a step-by-step process of moving toward further reductions in nuclear weapons, and including in the future moving to a multilateral approach in that regard. So there is, I think, a lot that is out there in terms of setting the stage for further reductions. But in terms of where exactly we will be going and what we will be doing in terms of further reductions, it depends a lot, I think, on both the work that we're doing in-house, our homework that is still in train, as I mentioned, and in what we are able to establish with the Russians as the groundwork for further negotiations. I would like to just take this opportunity to mention that a lot of people are saying, you know, what's going on? The Russians don't seem to be very interested. What's the situation here? I'd like to just mention that you may recall that I was the director of the Carnegie Moscow Center in 2008, in the period between 2006 and 2008. And I have to say this period to me is very, very reminiscent of that period in which the Russians were keeping their powder dry, so to say, on the nuclear arms control agenda, but were very engaged and very involved behind the scenes, whether in the second track or in some quiet government talks in terms of setting the stage for the reduction negotiations that turned into the New START Treaty negotiations. So I don't particularly concern myself with the environment as it is at the present time. Again, experienced it before, and we'll see what happens in 2013. But that's my answer to your question, Bill. We'll see what happens in 2013. Other questions? Okay, please.
Gerald Post, George Washington University. The other George in Washington.
You may not be heard by the rest of the hall, so perhaps...
Gerald Post, George Washington University. You underline the importance of the word modernization. I thought one of the interesting dilemmas in the last conference discussion concerned the need to modernize our forces, but the ban on the test ban bomb, the test bomb ban, and especially as you talk about non-strategic weapons, how do you see us getting to that reduced force while the ban is in place?
I'm sorry, could you just maybe one more time on your question?
The efficacy of the test bomb ban.
The CTBT, yes.
Uh-huh. Has been well demonstrated, is considered very important. But how do we go about modernizing our forces, especially if moving towards smaller tactical weapons in the face of that?
As I mentioned in my remarks, we're not actually modernizing our forces or acquiring any new nuclear capabilities. We are, and the President's been very clear about this, we are committed, for as long as nuclear weapons exist, to sustain a safe, secure, and effective arsenal. And that is really the work that our national laboratories and the Department of Energy, National Nuclear Security Administration are devoted to. We have acquired an amazing toolbox over the past decade plus. From the last time I worked in the Department of Energy in the late 1990s, the maturation of the Stockpile Stewardship Program has been impressive. So I think we do have the tools at our disposal to sustain a safe, secure, and effective nuclear arsenal without nuclear testing. But it is the policy of the United States not to acquire new nuclear capabilities and new nuclear missions. Yes, Michael Crapon. I recognize that face. We have a microphone for Mr. Crapon.
Rose, appreciate the work you do. You didn't talk about the space code of conduct today. Could you give us a sense where this is at? We've tried to encourage the European Union to step ahead on this, but it's not clear that the capability exists now to take the lead on this at the EU. Do you see a next step?
Actually, Michael, first off the bat, I would like to thank you for your work in advancing a space code of conduct, which, you know, we are really keen to ensure that countries are gathering around to cooperate on mitigating the effects of space debris and other problems that can affect our all-important space-based capabilities, satellite communications and other capabilities. So I wanted to take a moment just to thank you for the work you've done to advance this agenda, because it's been very, very important in beginning to draw countries around the table. I would say, frankly, I think the work on the Space Code of Conduct is going better than it had been. I think that there has been a really intensified effort that has taken some time to get going, but I think that there is a very important discussion going on now, and we just last week finished a group of government experts meeting in New York at the UN that was also working on advancing some mutual goals with regard to confidence building measures in space. So I think that from my point of view, the Space Code of Conduct activities are going rather well. It is an activity that is shepherded by my deputy, Mr. Frank Rose. Many of you know him well, and he's been fully engaged and fully involved, and what he tells me is that it's really, really picking up steam now. Perhaps I'll take one more question, if there's one more. You have to turn on your microphone.
I think it's on.
There you go.
Elaine Grossman with National Journal. Madam Secretary, I understand your department is involved in an interagency review of the so-called gold standard in nuclear trade pacts, and whether to apply it and when to apply it in future trade pacts and renewal agreements. Can you update us on the status of that review and what it's pointing toward at this point? Thank you.
If you're not familiar with this, this is with regard to the agreements for nuclear cooperation, the so-called 1-2-3 agreements that are negotiated pursuant to the Atomic Energy Act. The only thing I really don't like this term gold standard, because in my view, our nonproliferation policy overall is always pursuing the highest standards with regard to driving forward our national policy efforts to prevent the proliferation of weapons of mass destruction. And so the notion that somehow everything else we're doing already is not served by our policy with regard to the 1-2-3 agreements does not sit well. But I will say that we're bearing in mind this question very, very carefully. We are continuing to review the matter internally, and I don't have anything further for you on that today. But just one thing I want to stress again, everything we do is to a very high standard. There's not a single item that is the gold standard. Everything we do is to prevent proliferation of weapons of mass destruction. We're paying attention to it every single day, and by the way, it wakes me up in the middle of many nights as well. So thank you very much for your attention. It was a pleasure to be here once again. Thank you.
Okay. Rose, if I may, first say thank you so much for making the time to come and spend time here. I know when you were here last year, you mentioned specifically how important you thought this symposium was and that you would be here. And I will tell you that she has had to move heaven and earth to do it. So thanks very much. The issue about how many folks we have here named Rose, I think, is an interesting one, and we'll have to make sure that we balance that against next year. But in the meantime, I think we can continue to say, and you're going to hate this, but a rose by any other name is still a rose. Thank you for being here, and please take this token. I hope this isn't what we gave you last year. It looks different this year. Good, and thanks. Just thought about that, but anyway, thank you so much. It is always wonderful to get your insights, and I must tell you and the rest of the folks in the room what a professional pleasure it is to work with you. Thanks. Thank you.